Hello, welcome. Today's study is for December 7th, and it is in fact December 7th, 2023. The time is 1431 hours, I should say, Eastern Standard Time. Ward Green with you again, studying the Crucible of Credible Creed. And we are also currently studying 2 Samuel, the book of Jeremiah, and the book of Matthew. We're reading those books. In the Crucible article, it's chapter 1, paragraph 7, where we see, as we read here, little children, it appears true that chronology remains the truest test of the creed, whether it be a discipline of science or faith. Because of the great amount of information available about the Egyptian chronology due to the work of archaeology as correlated with astronomy, pottery, or radiocarbon dating, the opportunity offers itself to examine the Bible through the Egyptian chronology and the, quote, foreign rulers, unquote, Hyksos. This marks the first time that we will consider the Hyksos in correlation to the time of the Israelites who lived in Egypt, and how the biblical story may directly correspond. Hatshepsut, the Egyptian pharaoh who began to rule in 1490 BCE, made an inscription that showed that the Hyksos found their way out of Egypt sometime before her reign started. And this is the quote from the Egyptian pharaoh Hatshepsut, who was a woman. She said, "Hear ye, all people and the folk, as many as they may be. I have done these things through the counsel of my heart. I have not slept forgetfully, but I have restored that which had been ruined. I have raised up that which had gone to pieces formerly, since the Asiatics were in the midst of avarice of the Northland, and vagabonds were in the midst of them, overthrowing that which had been made." The fascinating thing there, she mentions the city called Avarice, which is, of course, as we've written about in our articles about the genealogy, we've written that Avarice is, in fact, a form of the word Eber, where the V becomes a B, or is equivalent to a B, and the vowels are not really that important in ancient languages, especially Hebrew, or any of the Abjad languages, which were Asiatic languages. So Avarice is this city that was evidently founded by the descendants of Heber, who was, it's from his name that the word Hebrew comes. But this mention is fascinating. This, the vagabonds is the most fascinating part of this, because there were vagabonds, she said, in the midst of these northern Asiatics in Egypt. And does that not sound like it could have been a very accurate description of what the Israelites were like when they were leaving Egypt as a large group of millions of people, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people together, leaving Egypt but living off the land? Or they must have looked like vagabonds, certainly not dressed in the greatest or the finest of clothing for their travels, which they were about to undertake through the wilderness. It sounds like a perfect description of them. At the time of Moses, and that inscription was from the Spios Artemidos, it was an inscription. At the time of Moses, and at the time of Joseph, chronology is assisted by means of two astronomical observations made and recorded at the two respective times so that the date at which each pharaoh begins to rule is established to the most accurate degree in the archaeological majority view. Fascinating fact about the chronology of Egypt is that we have these two astronomical observations, both of which were of the star Sothis, and they occurred at the time of someone who appears in the image shown just after this paragraph, who is Amenhotep I. In his reign, there was an observation of the rising of the star Sothis, which gives us an idea exactly when that was, because we know from astronomy, we can calculate when that star would have risen in the way that it does. And the other one was the other rising. By the way, Amenhotep ruled from about 21 years, from approximately 1526 to 1505 or so, I think is what we're saying. But in that range, very close to those dates, BCE. But the other rising of Sothis that was observed as an astronomical event that was so important to the chronology of Egypt was one that occurred in the 12th dynasty. This dynasty here, what was it, the 18th dynasty, I think? With Amenhotep I? I think it's the 18th dynasty. Wait a minute, 14th, 15th. Yeah, it seems hard to believe it's the 18th dynasty. Anyway, we can look that up. I don't think I have it available to look up, but I could just do a search and find it. But it's not that important what dynasty it was. It was in the 1500s BCE. I mean, it is important. It's just that it's not important to know it right now. But I think it's the 18th dynasty that was so famous. But now I'm thinking that Ramesses II was in the 19th dynasty, but maybe that's not true. Let's see. 1405. He was 1315, which is hundreds of years later. So that wouldn't seem to fit. What was the dynasty? 12, 15, 16. We should look it up. Okay, let's look it up. Amenhotep. Let's look up Amenhotep the first. I just don't want to be without. I need to know this. 18th dynasty, right. Okay, and then we have Senusret III. He was in the 12th dynasty. He's the other pharaoh. So, anyway, and that was in the year 18. I'm trying to think now. Let's see. 1872, I believe, in his year 7, is when we believe in BCE years. The observation was made on the star Sothis that was recorded during the reign of Senusret III. Yeah, because 19 years would be 1897 for year 1 for Senusret II, and that is a number that I remember. So, our proverb for today, little children, is from Proverbs 15, verse 1. An answer when mild turns away rage, but a word causing pain makes anger to come up. That was from Proverbs 15. Now our reading from 2 Samuel. Where is it? Let's see. 6. And David proceeded again to gather all the choice men in Israel, 30,000. Then David and all the people that were with him rose up and went to Baal-e-Judah, to bring up from there the Ark of the True God, where a name is called on, the name of Jehovah of Armies, sitting on the cherubs. However, they had the Ark of the True God ride upon a new wagon, that they might carry it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. And Uzzah and Ahio, the sons of Abinadab, were leading the new wagon. So they carried it from Abinadab's house, which was on the hill, with the Ark of the True God. and Ahio was walking ahead of the ark. And David and all the house of Israel were celebrating before Jehovah with all sorts of instruments, of juniper wood, and with harps, and with stringed instruments, and with tambourines, and with sistrums, and with cymbals. And they came gradually as far as the threshing floor of Nacon. And Uzzah now thrust his hand out to the ark of the true God and grabbed hold of it, for the cattle nearly caused an upset. At that, Jehovah's anger blazed against Uzzah, and the true God struck him down there for the irreverent act, so that he died there close by the ark of the true God. And David became angry over the fact that Jehovah had broken through in a rupture against Uzzah, and that place came to be called Perez Uzzah down to this day. And David became afraid of Jehovah on that day, and began to say, "How will the ark of Jehovah come to me?" And David was not willing to remove the ark of Jehovah to him at the city of David. So David had it carried aside to the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite. And the ark of Jehovah kept dwelling at the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, 3 months. And Jehovah kept blessing Obed-Edom and all his household. Finally, the report was made to King David, saying, "Jehovah has blessed the house of Obed-Edom and all that is his on account of the ark of the true God." At that, David proceeded to go and bring the ark of the true God out of the house of Obed-Edom up to the city of David with rejoicing. And it came about that when the carriers of the ark of Jehovah had marched 6 steps, he immediately sacrificed a bull and a fatling. And David was dancing around before Jehovah with all his power, all the while David being girded with an ephod of linen. And David and all the house of Israel were bringing up the ark of Jehovah with joyful shouting and sound of horn. And it occurred that when the ark of Jehovah came into the city of David, Michal, Saul's daughter, herself looked down through the window and got to see King David leaping and dancing around before Jehovah, and she began to despise him in her heart. So they brought the ark of Jehovah in and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. After which David offered up burnt sacrifices and communion sacrifices before Jehovah. When David was finished with offering up the burnt sacrifices and the communion sacrifices, he then blessed the people in the name of Jehovah of armies. Further, he apportioned to all the people, to the whole crowd of Israel, man as well as woman, to each one, a ring-shaped cake of bread and a date cake and a raisin cake, after which all the people went each to his own house. David now returned to bless his own household, and Michal, Saul's daughter, came on out to meet David and then said, "How glorious the king of Israel made himself today when he uncovered himself today to the eyes of the slave girls of his servants, just as one of the empty-headed men uncovers himself outright." At this, David said to Michal, "It was before Jehovah who chose me rather than your father and all his household to put me in command as leader over Jehovah's people Israel, and I will celebrate before Jehovah, and I will make myself even more lightly esteemed than this, and I will become low in my eyes, and with the slave girls whom you mentioned, with them I am determined to glorify myself." So as regards Michal, Saul's daughter, she came to have no child down to the day of her death. That concludes 2 Samuel chapter 6 about the bringing of the ark to Jerusalem by King David. The last we heard of it was Samuel regaining the ark from the Philistines, and the wonderful defeat, of course, after the Philistines had sent the wagon back to Israel, because for them it was causing a lot of trouble. Now, Jeremiah chapter 41, so it came about in the 7th month that Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, the son of Elishama, of the royal offspring, and of the principal men of the king, and 10 other men with him came to Gedaliah the son of Ahikam at Mizpah. And there they began to eat bread together in Mizpah. Then Ishmael the son of Nethaniah and the 10 men that happened to be with him rose up and struck down Gedaliah the son of Ahikam the son of Shaphan with the sword. So he put to death the one whom the king of Babylon had commissioned over the land. And all the Jews who happened to be with him, that is, with Gedaliah in Mizpah, and the Chaldeans who were found there, that is, the men of war, Ishmael struck down. And it came about on the second day of the putting of Gedaliah to death, when there was no one at all that knew it, then there came men from Shechem, from Shiloh, and from Samaria, 80 men with their beards shaved off and with their garments ripped apart and with cuts made upon themselves. And there were grain offering and frankincense in their hand to bring to the house of Jehovah. So Ishmael the son of Nethaniah went out from Mizpah to meet them weeping while he was walking along. And it came about that as soon as he encountered them, he proceeded to say to them, "Come to Gedaliah the son of Ahikam." But it occurred that as soon as they came into the midst of the city, Ishmael the son of Nethaniah went slaughtering them and throwing them into the midst of the cistern, he and the men that were with him. But there were 10 men that were found among them who immediately said to Ishmael, "Do not put us to death, for there exists in our possession hidden treasures in the field, wheat and barley and oil and honey." So he refrained, and he did not put them to death in the midst of their brothers. Now the cistern into which Ishmael threw all the carcasses of the men that he had struck down was a great cistern, the one that King Asa had made because of Baasha the king of Israel. It was the one that Ishmael the son of Nethaniah filled with those slain. Then Ishmael took captive all the remnant of the people who were in Mizpah, the daughters of the king and all the people who were remaining over in Mizpah, whom Nebuzaradan the chief of the bodyguard had put in the custody of Gedaliah the son of Ahikam. So Ishmael the son of Nethaniah took them captive and went off to cross over to the sons of Ammon. In time Johanan the son of Kareah and all the chiefs of the military forces who were with him got to hear all the bad that Ishmael the son of Nethaniah had done. Consequently they took all the men and went off to fight against Ishmael the son of Nethaniah and found him by the abundant waters that were in Gibeon. Then it came about that as soon as all the people that were with Ishmael saw Johanan the son of Kareah and all the chiefs of the military forces who were with him, they began to rejoice. And all the people whom Ishmael had led captive from Mizpah proceeded to turn around and return and go to Johanan the son of Kareah. And as for Ishmael the son of Nethaniah, he escaped with 8 men from before Johanan. He ran away, evidently, that he might go to the sons of Ammon. Johanan, the son of Kareah, and all the chiefs of the military forces who were with him, now took all the remnant of the people whom they brought back from Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, from Mizpah, after he had struck down Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, able-bodied men, men of war, and the wives and the little children and the court officials whom he brought back from Gibeon. So they went and took up dwelling in the lodging place of Kimham that was beside Bethlehem, in order to go on and enter into Egypt because of the Chaldeans, for they had become afraid because of them, since Ishmael the son of Nethaniah had struck down Gedaliah the son of Ahikam, whom the king of Babylon had commissioned over the land. That's the end of Jeremiah 41. And now Matthew. We didn't finish Matthew 13, but let's read 14 first. Maybe we'll have time to go back to 13. At that particular time, Herod, the district ruler, heard the report about Jesus and said to his servants, "This is John the Baptist. He was raised up from the dead." No, we have to do Matthew 15 today. That's right. So we did do 14 already. At the end of 14, maybe we'll do it now. Jesus, eventually having sent the crowds away, he went up into the mountain by himself to pray. I think we've got time to do this. Though it became late, he was there alone. By now the boat was many hundreds of yards away from land, being hard put to it by the waves, because the wind was against them. But in the fourth watch period of the night, he came to them walking over the sea. The disciples were troubled when they caught sight of him walking on the sea, And they said, "It is an apparition," and they cried out in their fear. But at once Jesus spoke to them with the words, "Take courage, it is I, have no fear." In reply, Peter said to him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you over the waters." He said, "Come." Thereupon Peter, getting down off the boat, walked over the waters and went toward Jesus. But looking at the windstorm, he got afraid, and after starting to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately stretching out his hand, Jesus caught hold of him and said to him, "You with little faith, why did you give way to doubt?" And after they got up into the boat, the windstorm abated. Then those in the boat did obeisance to him, saying, "You are really God's son." And they got across and came to land in Gennesaret. So Jesus, on this occasion, did not calm the storm. This was not that particular occasion. Upon recognizing him in Gennesaret, the men of that place sent forth into all that surrounding country, and people brought him all those who were ill, and they went entreating him that they might just touch the fringe of his outer garment. And all those who touched it were made completely well. What a healer this was. But he could walk on water is what the disciples learned, and that convinced them that he was really God's son. He could walk on water. I mean, what cannot he do? What can he not do? To be more grammatically correct in English, what can he not do is the correct grammar there. Jesus. Then there came to Jesus, chapter 15 of Matthew now, from Jerusalem, Pharisees and scribes, saying, "Why is it your disciples overstep the tradition of the men of former times? For example, they do not wash their hands when about to eat a meal." In reply, he said to them, "Why is it you also overstep the commandment of God because of your tradition? For example, God said, 'Honor your father and your mother,' and 'Let him that reviles father or mother end up in death.' But you say, 'Whoever says to his father or mother, whatever I have by which you might get benefit from me, is a gift dedicated to God, he must not honor his father at all.' And so you have made the word of God invalid because of your tradition." In other words, they said, he has no obligation to honor his father at all. "You hypocrites," Jesus went on, "Isaiah aptly prophesied about you when he said, 'This people honors me with their lips, yet their heart is far removed from me. It is in vain that they keep worshiping me because they teach commands of men as doctrines.'" And that is a quote from Isaiah, apparently, Isaiah 29:13, right? "They've come near with their mouths, and they've glorified me merely with their lips, but they have removed their heart itself far from me, and their fear toward me becomes men's commandment that is being taught." Isaiah 29:13. With that, he called the crowd near and said to them, "Listen and get the sense of it. Not what enters into his mouth defiles a man," because they were talking about washing their hands before a meal, "but it is what proceeds out of his mouth that defiles a man." Then the disciples came up and said to him, "Do you know that the Pharisees stumbled at hearing what you said?" In reply, he said, "Every plant that my heavenly Father did not plant will be uprooted. Let them be. Blind guides is what they are. If then a blind man guides a blind man, both will fall into a pit." By way of response, Peter said to him, "Make the illustration plain to us." At this he said, "Are you also yet without understanding? Are you not aware that everything entering into the mouth passes along into the intestines and is discharged into the sewer? However, the things proceeding out of the mouth come out of the heart, and those things defile a man." So you see, if you inhale something, like a substance, and then breathe it out again, that's proceeding out of your mouth, right? That would defile you. Because we're not supposed to do that with our breath. But Jesus is talking about eating. And then how, when we eat, the things don't usually come back out of the mouth. But words come out of our mouth when we speak. And those things do defile a man. For example, out of the heart, verse 19, They come out of the heart, these things that come out of the mouth. Verse 19, for example, out of the heart come wicked reasonings, murders, adulteries, fornications, thieveries, false testimonies, blasphemies. These are the things, Jesus said, defiling a man. But to take a meal with unwashed hands does not defile a man. Quite an astonishing statement, really, for many people who've been taught differently. Leaving there, Jesus now withdrew into the parts of Tyre and Sidon. And look, a Phoenician woman from those regions came out and cried aloud, saying, have mercy on me, Lord, Son of David. My daughter is badly demonized. But he did not say a word in answer to her. So his disciples came up and began to request him, send her away, because she keeps crying out after us. In answer, he said, I was not sent forth to any, but to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. When the woman came, she began doing obeisance to him, saying, Lord, help me. In answer, he said, it is not right to take the bread of the children and throw it to little dogs. She said, yes, Lord, but really, the little dogs do eat of the crumbs falling from the table of their masters. Then Jesus said in reply to her, O woman, great is your faith. Let it happen to you as you wish. And her daughter was healed from that hour on. Her daughter was healed. That's astonishing, is it not? Crossing country from there, Jesus next came near the Sea of Galilee. And after going up into the mountain, he was sitting there. Then great crowds approached him, having along with them people that were lame, maimed, blind, dumb, and many otherwise, and they fairly threw them at his feet, and he cured them, so that the crowd felt amazement as they saw the dumb speaking, and the lame walking, and the blind seeing, and they glorified the God of Israel. But Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I feel pity for the crowd, because it is already 3 days that they have stayed with me, and they have nothing to eat. And I do not want to send them away fasting. They may possibly give out on the road. However, the disciples said to him, where are we in this lonely place going to get sufficient loaves to satisfy a crowd of this size? At this, Jesus said to them, how many loaves have you? They said, seven and a few little fishes. So after instructing the crowd to recline upon the ground, he took the seven loaves and the fishes, and after offering thanks, he broke them and began distributing to the disciples in turn to the crowds, and all ate and were satisfied. And as a surplus of fragments, they took up seven provision baskets full. Yet those eating were 4,000 men, besides women and young children. Weren't even counting the women and children. Finally, after sending the crowds away, he got into the boat and came into the regions of Magadan. And that is the end of our Bible reading for today. That concludes Matthew 15 also. And it's almost the end of our video, but no, we have another 4.5 minutes or so in our video. But it's remarkable. I think the scriptures are always very useful because they have this spirit of truth embedded in them. They're a product of the Holy Spirit, which is the spirit of truth. And whenever we read them, we get truth embedded into us. And so it's always the greatest thing to read the scriptures. And if we can do it every day, it's just incredibly beneficial for us. It just benefits us in untold ways, but in many, many ways. And the benefits are things that it manifests in our lives, that we see our lives getting better in many respects. Of course, we still need to read other things. I research nutrition, for example, as much as possible. As I'm learning about it, I do research to back up the learning I'm doing, but also to prevent mistakes and to learn more about how to use nutrition in my life to benefit me and in some cases maybe help others, but mainly it's the ability to essentially reverse aging or prevent aging, that vitamins have this ability to do. Like, even just vitamin C is an immensely powerful antioxidant that's been used to cure cancer and to wipe out infections. Even the common cold is cured with vitamin C. It's a powerful thing. But curing infections, which is what vitamin C does, but it does, of course, it does other things that are good in the body. But the main thing it does is this curing of infections. So just vitamin C alone cannot make you live forever, because you need other things besides, I mean, infections are not the only thing that can kill you. So you need other things besides the ability to cure infections. So there are many other things that I'm interested in. The use of many other things like vitamin B12, selenium and boron are two mineral elements that I use personally in my vitamin and mineral regimen. Iodine is very important. It's another one that I take as a supplement. And, well, there are many others, glutathione and vitamin E and so on. Where was our article? Let's see. That's from the... It's from the other article, isn't it? Okay, this is the one. Yeah, that was from the Born and Raised article that we were studying before. We have a couple of minutes. Wonder if we should try and read some of that, because we were looking at the Born and Raised, right? I added a footnote to chapter 12 in the Born and Raised article, paragraph 7 of chapter 12. I added the long footnote. So let me read some of that. Okay. Yeah, it's possible that it would have been possible that Jesus could have had the Passover evening meal with his disciples on Thursday, along with both the Sadducees and the traditional Jews, and then that the crucifixion came on Friday, Nisan 14, provided that Nisan 1 is exactly 13 days prior to that, and this Friday is April 7th in the year 30 CE, for example, thus permitting the possibility of the traditional date for the crucifixion. This is using Gauchy's day, with Nisan 1 as March 25th, as it says there at the top of this footnote. But this fails, however, according to Luke 23 and 56, because it was not allowed to do any work on the day of Passover from Exodus 12 and 16, which excludes the possibilities of work such as executing Jesus, which is work, or preparation of spices. This doesn't preclude that Nisan 14 was Friday, April 7th in 30 CE. Okay, we're out of time. For both Sadducees and Pharisees. Okay. But it puts the crucifixion date on Thursday, which was Nisan 14 of the Essenes, only in the year 30 CE, etc. So we didn't get to read it all, but it's the time to conclude the video. I'm Ward Green. It's December 7th, 2023. The time is 15:04 Eastern Standard Time. This is Crow. And this is Cassie, my two beautiful watches, saying in my behalf, bye for now. I love you.